What's up, dude?
How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I am doing good. We have a hell of a show today.
Yes, we do. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Movie Nights Roundtable. We're going to kick things off with a couple trailers, actually. Some trailer talk from last week. Let's start with Maxine.
Oh, boy.
Maxine, first of all, I love X. I love Pearl, in case you didn't tell. And I was already excited for the movie. Already. I am infinitely more excited. That trailer looks so fucking good.
It was a really good trailer.
I'm so excited. It definitely looks a little bit more expensive. They finally gave him more than $1 million to make one of these.
Well, it was $1 million for the first two, wasn't it?
No, both, I think, got $1 million.
Oh, I thought it was $1 million total. My bad.
No, all good. But still, it's like crazy how well those movies were made for their budgets. And this one looks slightly more expensive. It doesn't look like a crazy spend, but I mean,
like 10 max, maybe?
Yeah, but like, Mia Goth looks great. Giancarlo Esposito looks great. Everybody looks amazing.
I mean, just the names he... I mean, I'm on IMDb right now. Mia Goth, Elizabeth Debicki?
Debicki, yeah.
Debicki, you know, Michelle Monaghan, Bobby Cannavale, who I love, Lily Collins, Halsey, Giancarlo Esposito, Kevin fucking Bacon. What?
We love Kevin Bacon.
The vibes are immaculate. The setting, you know, I love the aesthetic that they are leaning into with it.
Yeah. And I love how distinctly each film in this X trilogy is different. Even from the trailer, we haven't seen the third one, obviously, but it feels different from the first two.
Well, I think he's been describing Maxine as like a this like whodunit slasher.
Which would be amazing. Yeah.
And like you said, yeah, I love that the first one was sort of just a typical slasher sort of movie here. The second one, you kind of get into like this deep character psycho thriller backstory type thing, and now they're just like, we're gonna have fun, it's a whodunit.
Yeah, speaking of Psycho, her visiting the Universal lot and seeing Pearl in the Bates house, what a shot.
It was pretty
what cool. A shot. It was beautiful. But yeah, I'm super excited about Maxine. I cannot wait for this movie. What do you guys think about the Maxine trailer? Did it increase your excitement? Have you seen X or Pearl? And if not, why? Please watch them. Now there's another trailer we gotta talk about.
Definitely before this movie comes out.
Yes. Yeah. There's another trailer we got to talk about. Joker, Filet au Deux.
Joker 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's call it.
I really liked the new Joker trailer. I think it was really good. It's definitely going in a direction that I think was a smart idea, because it looks like obviously similar vibes from the first movie, but in a new sort of direction. I think Lady Gaga looks great as Harley Quinn. I kind of like the surrealism that they're going with. And I'm very curious, as more trailers come out, to see more of the actual story. Because, yes, a lot of it, the first Joker relies on an unreliable narrator, how much of this is true, how much of it isn't. But it definitely looks like at some point they break out of that fucking Arkham.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to see how that plays out in the movie. And it doesn't look like she's a doctor either. It looks like she's a patient, which I think is an interesting twist.
I thought that was interesting, yeah.
On the story. But regardless, what are your thoughts on the Joker trailer?
I agree with that. I thought it looked cool to see just this idea that maybe Harley just was also already a crazy person and we're going to put these forces together as opposed to... Because what will be interesting then is she's not necessarily like indebted to the Joker if they do go that route.
Yeah.
I think what has been interesting to see, though, is, you know, there's all this... The talk that this was going to be a musical and... On top of that, a jukebox musical where they are just covering songs that are already written, you know, popular song, kind of like Mamma Mia with ABBA, but that was just all ABBA.
Yeah.
The trailer didn't mark it as a musical, which
but
is musical.
But it definitely talked about music.
It definitely talked about music, and that's the weird thing that the director has kind of been saying. Is it Todd Phillips, right?
Yeah.
That's the director's name. He was saying, I wouldn't describe it as a musical as much as a movie where music is an essential element of it, which to me just feels like movie musicals have not really had a lot of well reception lately.
Yeah.
And I feel like that they are doubling down on trying to not market as that. But I think we're fully getting a jukebox musical.
But I think what's funny, too, is I think the reason why they're not getting good reception is because people don't know they're musicals. And so, like, that audience,
correct, yeah.
that audience that wants a musical, who gets a musical marketed and goes, they're going to think of the movie highly.
Yeah.
If you don't want a musical and you go and you get a musical, you can be like, oh, this movie sucks, and the reception's going to go down. But did it work money-wise? Sure. I mean, Mean Girls did fairly well for a movie that was supposed to go straight to Paramount. So you know, it's just one of those things that I find interesting. And I'm curious to see how much of it actually is a jukebox musical and how much is just like really good needle drops. Like, I feel like it's going to be a mix. And I feel like the way that the Joker dances in his craze is maybe Harley sings. And I feel like that's kind of the...
Like, we're not going to necessarily see Joaquin Phoenix singing. It might just all be Lady Gaga.
Yeah, and it might be a mix of both as they kind of come together.
And I love the visual, like the practical sets that mm-hmm. look like these big stage play, like 50s movie type deal. And it very looks very tonally similar to the first one, aesthetically, even everything, you know, just transitions really well into it. I think what gets me most excited, and I know the rebuttal is just, well, I would do anything too for the check that I'm probably getting.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. Joaquin, very selective of his roles, and coming off of an Oscar win for this role specifically and never doing any sequels, then signs on for the Joker 2 jukebox musical.
Yeah.
So I don't want to just write it off as just that, because I feel like for him to take on that role is something different. But again, what did the articles say he was getting paid? Like 10 million?
20.
20 million? I'd probably do the musical too.
Yeah. But and it is a good point, and I think money definitely has something to do with it 100%, especially after that Oscar win.
Yeah.
But because I think he was paid $4 million for the first one. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure it was four. And obviously he's going to get his money. But I also think this is the first musical he's ever done, or not musical, excuse me, first sequel he's ever done, to my knowledge.
I think the first musical, is it not?
Might be two. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely the first sequel he's ever done. And that decision is clearly intentional.
Yeah.
And if you look back at the interviews and the press for Joker 1, he says in those interviews, like, you know, Todd and I were talking, like, there might be more to tell with this. Like, he didn't seem opposed to it from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was designed to be a one-off movie, but when your budget's 50 and you make $1 billion, you're going to make a second movie. Mm-hmm. Now, how well it does, we'll have to see. I don't think it'll do as well as the first one, but I definitely think it's going to make good money for sure.
The first one made $1 billion pretty quickly, and I feel like a $1 billion movie is very rare these days.
Yeah.
They're very few and far between.
They are, but also you also have a bigger profit margin now, because the budget of this is like $200 million. Mm-hmm. So if you make $1 billion, you're still well within profit, but that margin is not as high.
Yeah.
So they probably want more, but I think I could see this finishing. I will happily eat my words if I'm wrong about this. I could see this finishing within the 700 to 800 range, mm-hmm. which is still a good, like, a profit for the movie. It just won't be as high of a margin that they want.
I'm very curious to see, because I feel like I've seen this trend before. I'm very curious if we're going to get some, like, Joker revisionist, like, critiques. Or, like, I feel like as we get closer to this movie, for whatever reason, the internet's just going to turn on the original Joker movie.
Well, I mean, a lot of people already just didn't like it when it came out.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty divisive amongst a lot of critics and fans. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, not the Academy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it also wouldn't shock me if people see how this movie afterwards, not necessarily in the buildup, like maybe if they really dislike this movie, people who like the first Joker will go back and be like, oh, it's not that good.
Yeah.
Or if they really like this movie, people might go back to the first one and be like, oh, I guess it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you kind of see that all the time now, especially in the age of the internet. It's fucking aggravating.
Yeah.
But yeah.
One person's going to tweet about Joker being bad, and then it's just going to
snowball. There it goes. Well, what did you guys think about the trailer for Joker Filet au Doux? Are you as excited as us? How much money do you think it'll make in its total worldwide one? Let us know in the comments as we move on to our news story section of the show. Had to slow down so I could get words
there,
out.
Though.
Yep, we did. Nick, what's the first story you got for us?
Our first story comes to us from The Hollywood Reporter, and it's a follow-up to a story we talked about recently, and that is that Netflix has a new head, Dan Lin. And Dan Lin is now starting to do his changes, and that is that the film division is undergoing a complete genre-based reorganization.
Yes.
Which is a very interesting thing.
It is. It's quite interesting, and I'm going to dive into it, obviously, here. But I have no idea if this is a good or bad thing. I have very mixed feelings on this.
I think it's very... Well, we can talk about it.
Yeah. So let me pull up from The Hollywood Reporter here. Netflix's film division is getting a reorg under a new head, Dan Lin. Several sources tell The Hollywood Reporter that the features division at the streaming service will now be split up by genre, such as sci-fi, rom-com, and faith-based. While Lin officially started his Netflix tenure April 1st, sources note that the reorganization has been in the works for over a month, with Lin consulting chief content officer Bella Baharia and the streamer's film heads and outside partners. Under the new structure, I'm going to butcher these names, sorry. Ori Marmer will oversee action, fantasy, horror, and sci-fi titles. Kira Goldberg will handle thrillers, dramas, and family films. Interesting pairing. Nyjah Key Kendall will oversee faith-based young adult and holiday offerings, while Jason Young will handle comedies and rom-coms. As a part of the restructuring, there will also be some departures, with a source noting the number will be around 12, but that number could change. So basically, some people are going to get fired. But yeah, I'm very mixed on this whole thing. Because while I think it's interesting, especially for a streaming service, because they've pretty much committed, like, we're not going to get into the theatrical business, even though we can make so much money, and it's a really dumb decision. I'm not over it. But as a streaming service, they're kind of looking at the numbers, and especially now that these numbers are public from the strikes, kind of going, what are our biggest hits? What are our biggest things? Let's restructure this way, have certain people run these divisions, people with... I'm assuming the people running the more popular divisions have more experience in the industry. I'm assuming, I don't really know the names that were listed. Mm-hmm. But basically kind of taking this approach, seeing how it works, seeing if it's successful for the business. Where my concern falls is the how good the films will be. Because we know that budgets are being cut back. And if you have a rom-com family division, that makes sense. They're not that expensive film to make. And we know Dan Lin is very serious about the mid-budget movie doing well on streaming, especially in that rom-com genre. Mm-hmm. So while giving rom-coms its own space, I think was kind of writing on the wall. Breaking it up this much, I'm curious about the quality of the films. I think as a business move, purely business, it's smart because you're kind of taking things, putting them in a box, and making sure that the numbers fit this box and the success rate based on this box is working. But when you structure something that specific, can it affect the quality of the films? But the backwards argument there is, well, the Netflix films haven't been very high quality anyway. So yeah. what's the damage? So my brain is racked about this. Nicholas, what's the answer?
Well, on a surface level, I think it's an interesting concept, right? Because if you're looking at movie studios, and I'll go super high level, and I'll go with, let's take a look at Disney, and let's take a look at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Even Sony, right? So what do they have? Well, not Sony. Marvel and Star Wars are separate studios underneath Disney. They focus solely on those. Same thing with Warner Brothers, now has DC Studios separate from the company as itself.
Yeah.
And they're handling specifically one type of project.
Yeah.
Well, Netflix is a studio, but it's a streaming service first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these buckets of different lines. You know, when you open the app right there, comedy, horror, fantasy. So it does almost sort of make sense to have this sort of division where you have these buckets, and it's an interesting concept to have specific studios, we'll call them mini studios, dedicated to that genre. But my issue with it is the best movies to me are ones that are a blend of multiple genres.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at something like The Nice Guys, that doesn't just fit into one bucket. And just like right now, let's take Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves. Okay, what does that have in it? That's an action movie. It's also a fantasy movie.
It's also a comedy.
It's also a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So is that Ori Marmer's department? Or is that Jason Young's department?
Dude, I wish I was in the room for these conversations. It's the age-old question of like, okay, the actor's wearing a hat, so it's a costume, but when he puts it on the table, it's a prop. So which department is responsible for the hat?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's pretty much the same thing. That's fascinating.
And not to say that there aren't movies that are just comedies and all just rom-coms, but I feel like we're not going to get these sort of very wide-scaping genre-based films. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with a genre film. If they want to make an action movie, great. Adam Sandler did that action movie with David Spade, The Do-Over.
Yeah.
Is that action? That had a lot of action in it. Or is it comedy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where does it, you know, how are they dividing that?
Yeah. It's a great question. I don't know the answer.
That would be where I'm interested in.
Yeah. And I think it's just going to be a great experiment to see how this works. Because
yeah.
I definitely see the red flags from this. It's kind of what you're saying of like, what about these mixed genre films and what about the overall quality? You know, is the quality control just going to flounder off because, well, it fits into the box of this department?
Well, again, like there's, you know, Nia Kuykendall is overseeing faith-based, young adult, and holiday. Okay, what are a lot of holiday offerings? Typically rom-coms.
Yeah.
You know, how does that work? YA, young adult. a lot of sci-fi in YA, young adult, yeah. You know, but that's a different, you know, so I'm curious to see how they'll do those buckets. And maybe that is just the synergy they're going to create between the departments.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll be a collab, but I'd be very interested to see, because it seems like really a lot of the scripts they're going to be getting, they're going to be really diluting into one thing. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if they will not kind of branch into those types of really mixed genre movies.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is that this is just a film division. This is not the TV division. Mm-hmm. And Netflix's TV shows are their biggest draws for the most part, with the exception of a handful of movies. So I'm wondering if the film division is successful, do you think the TV division, now granted it's a much harder division to handle because of how much TV there is.
Yeah.
But like, do you think that's something that they would even like contemplate doing, is like, all right, well, Stranger Things is over, but the replacement show for Stranger Things is sci-fi and young adult. So it's over here, you know, kind of what you were saying. Could you see TV going in this route if this is successful for them?
I feel like it would, but and that's the thing. What's interesting about TV is, too, you can have an episode that is really, like, you know, if you look at specifically even Stranger Things, there's some episodes that are just fully horror, and then there's some that are really sci-fi, and then there's sort of these light ones that are kind of a little more comedic relief type thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't see how they just... It's hyper-specific buckets that they're putting in, and I'm curious to see how this experiment pans out. Because on paper, on a high level, I could see it making sense. It's when you get down to those specifics that I don't know how it's going to work out.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very interesting discussion that I think we could honestly do 3 hours on, but for the sake of the show, we got to move on. But guys, what do you think about this Netflix division kind of reorganizing their structure based on genres? What do you think? Is it a good idea, bad idea? Are you mixed like us? Let us know in the comments as we move on to our next story. And Nicholas, what do you have for us next?
Our next story also comes to us from The Hollywood Reporter. Previously on the show as well, we talked about how Ryan Coogler, director of Black Panther and Black Panther 2.
And Creed.
And Fruitvale Station.
Yes.
Was directing a new supernatural thriller with Michael B. Jordan, his collaborator, set to star. This started a bidding war deep in January, and plot details are really kept under wraps right now, but not the cast, because Hailee Steinfeld has now joined the cast.
Yes, she has joined the cast, and speaking of the tight-lipped plot details, there are a couple that are baller. So I'm going to read it here, and but first, before I do that, what do we say is never a bad idea, Nicholas?
A bidding war?
Well, we love a bidding war, but it's never a bad idea to add talent.
Oh.
And Hailee Steinfeld, one of the goats working. So I'm going to pull this from The Hollywood Reporter. Hailee Steinfeld, who voices Gwen Stacy in the acclaimed Spider-Verse movies, will star opposite Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler's untitled supernatural thriller being made by Warner Brothers Pictures, the winners of the bidding war. The buzzy project, the object of a high-profile bidding war in January, heads before cameras later this month in New Orleans and has been furiously casting up. Actually, as of this recording, it has started production.
Oh, nice.
I'm going to butcher some of these names, but Womni Masku and Delroy Lindo and Jack O'Connell, among others, make up the already heady call sheet. Ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Little is known about the project. What is known and yet to be confirmed by either studio or Coogler, insiders say the feature is set in the Jim Crow era South and possibly involves both vampires and supernatural traditions. Jordan may be even playing dual roles as twin brothers.
Oh.
Basically, it's the vampires versus the KKK.
Oh.
Fuck yes. Are you joking? Are you absolutely kidding right now? I guarantee you something is involved where like a vampire either is hunting KKK or they have to protect someone from the KKK with Michael B. Jordan, Hailee Steinfeld, Delroy Lindo, countless others. Dude, sign me all the way the fuck up. All you had to tell me was that Ryan Coogler was making it and we were there.
Yeah, 100%.
This now? Come on, dude. And what I love about this is it's going to creatively refresh Ryan Coogler because he's been through a lot making kind of two back-to-back huge blockbuster films. And you can tell he kind of needs a minute to go do something that he really wants to make and do and get his creative juices flowing.
Yeah.
So that way, if he does another blockbuster in the future, he's back, baby. You know, like there's not a big tragic loss that's kind of affecting him. There's not like this, you know, studio reliance. It's just him and his talents. And I could not be more thrilled about this.
Plus, Michael B. Jordan with vampire teeth.
Michael B. Jordan with
sexy vampires are back.
Sexy vampires are back. You're right. You are right. If Hailee Steinfeld is a vampire, I'm going to redact whatever I was about to say.
Shameik Moore joins the cast.
This movie is easily becoming one of my most anticipated upcoming movies. I cannot fucking wait to watch this movie.
And it has a set release date of March 7th, 2025. So we don't have to wait that long for it.
Go. Let's
Man, they're cranking that out if they're just starting production.
They are. And that means we'll get a trailer by probably October for Halloween. Oh!
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yes, dude.
Pretty good.
I'm loving this. Guys, are you as excited as we are about this new Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan vampire movie, which now has Hailee Steinfeld joining the cast? Let us know as we move on to our next story. And Nicholas, what do you got for us next?
Our next story comes to us from Variety. Not so much a movie-based topic here, but one that Dalton and I both wanted to talk about over a mutual admiration for this man, and that is that Netflix has officially ordered a 6-episode dark comedy series from Tom Segura.
Yes, and the reason why we wanted to point this out, I mean, obviously, we're both fans of Tom Segura. Hannah and I saw him live recently. He's great. But what I found interesting about this is a passion project, so much so that it was self-financed, at least the pilot was, by Segura himself. So I kind of want to read from the Variety article here to kind of give you an insight as to what's going on. Per the official description, the currently untitled series centers on Segura, who also serves as the show's narrator. As he takes us through each episode in a series of vignettes, the twisted comedic sensibility of Tom's stand-up is the core DNA of the series, where every story will unfold in a hilariously disturbing way only he could imagine. Segura wrote, self-financed, and produced the pilot before selling it to Netflix, which is producing the full series later this year and releasing in 2025. Rami Hakak? Sorry if I said that wrong, directed the pilot. Netflix ordered the series based on a pilot that Segura produced himself. Was this written by AI? Jesus, repeating shit? Come on, Variety. But I find this fascinating. One, Tom Segura, very funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he self-produced this pilot and tried to sell it means he was really passionate about the story and thinks it can be a success. And Netflix, while they have a good relationship with Segura, it wasn't a guaranteed thing that they were going to buy something like this. So... And here's the thing that worries me. We've seen shows from comedians in the past, specifically based on their stand-up routines, that fail drastically, like the John Mulaney one.
How dare you? Yeah, it was pretty awful. Yeah. I watched every episode, guys.
But
put Martin Short in something, I'm going to watch
it. You're a simple guy.
I'm a very simple man. And it had Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
There you go. Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
A movie you've never seen.
This is true. Call me out on the show.
I am. I know what we're doing after.
Don't worry. I'm going to get the 4Ks and watch them. But anyway, I just found this fascinating, especially the self-finance part of it. Are you excited for this show? Do you think it'll be good for the streamer?
I think that coming off of his podcast popularity with Your Mom's House and
Two Bears, One Cave.
I think that Tom Segura has really built a very loyal fan base from it.
This is true.
And I think that he has a very specific type of humor that I don't think is necessarily for everyone, but I think that his fan base is wide-reaching enough that I see this being a success, especially if the show's good and he's passionate about it. I looked it up just because I was curious if the person who's directing the pilot has directed anything before.
Mm-hmm.
So he directed the music video for Bo Burnham's Repeat Stuff.
Okay.
And then he directed... two of Tom Segura's specials, Mostly Stories in 2016, as well as Ball Hog in 2020.
Gotcha.
So it is a collaborator with him, which is, I think, why he was name dropped in.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So, you know, I think that he's very passionate about this project. Both of them have a great working relationship together. So I think it'll be a success, depending on, you know, obviously I'm saying success. I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
Me every time I talk to Hannah.
I think there's a lot of passion that went into the project very clearly, and I don't think that Tom Segura would really, because he's not really an actor.
No.
And I don't think he would reach into that realm unless he was very confident in it, especially because he already has so many other successes.
I'm just curious that if they can get writers and storytellers to kind of adapt, in a sense, his material to a workable show.
Yeah.
I think that would be an interesting kind of like, I'm not saying it has to be in the same structure as like an Everybody Loves Chris type of deal, mm-hmm. but basically the way that they adapt stories into that, I think is well done.
Because the interesting part is that it is vignette.
Yeah.
So it is very, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a through line.
No.
Which is kind of, I think, the gamble of it. So it's more like a variety show.
Maybe it's more like a Chappelle Show type thing.
Yeah, Chappelle Show, what's the other, like, I think you should leave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that happening. But what do you guys think about Tom Segura's new Netflix show that's going to be coming out next year? Do you find it interesting that he self-financed it? Do you think that that shows a certain passion? Or was he just rich and was bored? Let us know in the comments as we move on to our next story. And Nicholas, what do you got for us next?
Next story is a rad one. Comes from The Hollywood Reporter.
Go on.
A live action R-rated Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie is in the works from producer Walter Hamada. And now when I say R-rated Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I want to clarify, this is in reference to the graphic novel The Last Ronin.
Yes, yes.
And to this I have to say, fuck yeah. And I can say that because it's R-rated.
Oh my god, yes. Great pull, great pull. For those of you that don't know, Kevin Feige at CinemaCon said the movie was fucking awesome and then followed up by saying, I can say that because it's R-rated.
Referring to Deadpool and Wolverine.
Correct. I'm going to pull from the article here. After the success of last year's animated hit film Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, Paramount Pictures is keeping Turtle Power going by putting a new feature project into development. This one, however, will go beyond the realm of all ages material the long-standing property is known for and instead go into a gritty R-rated territory. Paramount is developing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin, adapting a popular storyline seen in the recent IDW comics as a live-action feature with the intent of making it for an R rating. Tyler Burton-Smith, who co-wrote the upcoming R-rated action movie Boy Kills World, who wrote the 29 iteration of Chucky, is penning the script. Walter Hamada is producing through his 18HZ production company as part of his multi-year deal with the studio, which we reported on. Hamada is the former head of DC Films, who rose through the ranks at New Line once he oversaw Warner Brothers' division of horror movies, including The Conjuring and It franchises. So, let's talk about this.
Yes. Can I give some brief background on what The Last Ronin is?
Please do.
All right. The Last Ronin, I'm also pulling from the article, but I think it's important to have, is about as terrifying as a turtle's tail can get. Set in a totalitarian future New York City, the comic miniseries told of how the Turtles and Master Splinter are killed off one by one by the grandson of the villainous Shredder and his synthetic ninjas. One turtle manages to survive, barely, and vows to exact bloody vengeance. The trick, though, of the whole book is that you don't know which of the turtles survives, because he utilizes all four of their signature weapons. I say it once, I'll say it again, fuck yeah.
This is very exciting. I've never read the graphic novel. I do want to, especially after hearing that. But at the same time, what I find interesting is Walter Hamada's involvement, because when he was running DC, he was kind of the first one to let them do R-rated stuff, even in their universe at the time, which was a fucking mess. But like Birds of Prey, he greenlit. Even Joker, which is not in their universe, he was there to kind of help shepherd and greenlight that. So I feel like him, his voice is kind of the one who's being like, yeah, no, let's do it. Let's do this.
Yeah, if we're going to do it, we're going to do
it. I would especially love it if they did practical costumes again. Oh my goodness.
See, I think it would even be a great, like, animated movie.
Yeah.
I would have no issue with that, especially in the same style as the Mutant Mayhem movie.
Yeah.
But I think they probably don't want to blur the lines.
Yeah, and they don't want to confuse the audience of, like, what's involved with what.
If it was a direct sequel to the 90s.
The 90s?
Ones,
oh, my God.
That would be amazing.
It would be sick. But, yeah, I would, I mean, the R rating and the adapting of the novel, I think it's an interesting choice. It's something I'm excited to see. I'm kind of morbidly curious by it, because they're also continuing the animated franchise with a show on Paramount and a sequel coming out soon. So
I'd be very curious if Seth Rogen also kind of branches into any involvement in this one, because
maybe
he also, while he did help shepherd this new animated series, he does have a very big reputation right now as really helping to produce a lot of these graphic novel thing. You know, he's a producer on The Boys,
Invincible,
the Boys spinoff Gen V, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Oh, and he did Preacher, that show that was really big on AMC for quite a bit. What also does excite me, though, is that the co-writer for Boy Kills World is involved.
Yeah.
Because that trailer looks great.
And yes.
It looks like bloody fun.
Yeah, and I hope the movie is good. I really do hope it's good.
That's the gamble of it, but at least the action and the violence does look quite gratuitous, and I hope that they allow that to translate.
Side note on that movie, I heard a rumor. I have no idea if it's true, but I heard that when it did its festival run, there was no voiceover.
Oh.
And that they added that once it got bought for distribution.
Interesting.
I find that interesting as well. So we'll see if that's true, if that comes out to be true. And I don't know the reason for that. Maybe it was just a studio note. But anyway, I thought that was just something fun to throw in there. But yeah, this is interesting. I'm excited for it.
I am.
It could fail, but it could also succeed. And that's most human choices.
It's a big swing, and I'm excited for it.
I agree. Guys, what do you think about the live-action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie based on The Last Ronin coming from Paramount and Walter Hamada? Let us know in the comments as we move on to our final news topic story of the day before we move on to the box office. Nicholas, what do you got for us next?
Our next story comes to us from The Hollywood Reporter as well. It was a Hollywood Reporter was on it this week. They had a lot of the stories.
Yes, they were.
And that is that a Chris Farley biopic is officially in the works with Josh Gad set to direct and Paul Walter Hauser set to star as Chris Farley.
Yes, and they're doing that thing where they're kind of saying the thing with the Vulture of like Michael Keaton's in this movie playing the villain. The villain is Vulture, but they're not saying Michael Keaton's playing Vulture. Mm. It's the same thing of Paul Walter Hauser is the lead star in this movie. This movie is about Chris Farley, but they're not saying Paul Walter Hauser is playing Chris Farley.
Paul Walter Hauser to lead Chris Farley biopic.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of the thing. So I'll pull from the article here. Chris Farley, the legendary comedy actor behind Tommy Boy and countless Saturday Night Live performances, is getting the biopic treatment. Emmy winner Paul Walter Hauser will star in the project that has actor-filmmaker Josh Gad attached to direct. Saturday Night Live patriarch Lorne Michaels will produce, which is interesting, via his Broadway video banner. The screenplay will be written by sought-after duo Scott Neustadter and Michael H. Weber, based on the New York Times bestselling biography, The Chris Farley Show, a biography in three acts by Tom Farley Jr. and Tanner Colby. The project, which is currently being pitched around town, has the blessing of the Farley family. So, Josh Gad writing, directing is interesting.
Yes.
But I think if you're doing a biopic and that's your first go, it has to be a person in a story that you are passionate about. And him being in comedy, especially as a heavier set guy, it makes perfect sense that Chris Farley would be someone who he holds in high regard because he was kind of the poster child for that type of comedian breakthrough in the world. Paul Walter Hauser is an incredible actor. If he's playing Chris Farley, which he is, great choice. And look, maybe he's not. Could be wrong. Although the article very highly suggests that that's who's playing him. But I think Paul Walter Hauser is a great actor.
Yes.
I think that...
Oscar nominated, right?
I think so. Definitely Emmy. But especially given how sad Chris Farley's story is, especially how it ends, like the very end of his story, incredibly sad. I think you need an actor like Paul Walter Hauser to kind of be able to pull that off.
Emmys,
got it. But yeah, this has piqued my curiosity. One thing that I'm a little bit worried about is it has the blessing of the family. And you might be thinking, like, why would you take issue with that? My only issue with that is, are they going to be okay with diving into his darker side? Mm-hmm. And by darker side, I mean just his addictions and, the drugs, the overdose. Yeah, the sex workers that he would hire. Like, and it's not that that's necessarily the bad thing. It's just that apparently he was just such a lonely guy. Like, he would just... And, like, I don't know if this is a spoiler, if it's a true story, but essentially when he was dying, he was with a sex worker, and his last words to her were, like, just please don't leave me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an incredibly tragic story. And I think that it's an interesting way to go about this, because obviously it's going to have those comedic things being just about Chris Farley. But
yeah.
I think the Josh Gad involvement is what surprises me. How do you kind of feel about him taking the reins directorially on this?
I think it's an interesting choice, kind of going back to what you said. Chris Farley is probably someone Josh Gad holds in high regard.
Mm-hmm.
With a topic like that, it'll definitely be interesting, especially from a first-time director handling that. But I think that to its benefit, it does have the Lorne Michaels banner going on it as mm-hmm. well. And I think that, obviously, this is something that personally probably really weighs with Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
And I think that... sorry. I think that having these people kind of behind it that are holding... You know, it's going to be handled with care and respect and dignity, and I don't think they will shy away from those elements of it because that's who he was.
Yeah.
And I think that they're not going to try to, like... And Chris Farley is held in such comedy high regard by everyone that I think mm-hmm. if they don't really go into that, like, people talk so openly about everything with Farley, you know, especially if you look at like David Spade, who worked really closely with him. He's open about everything in regards to Farley, his anger issues, everything like that. So I think that there's enough out there that they don't have to like shy away from it.
Yeah.
It's not like there's going to be this big reveal like, what? Chris Farley had a drug addiction problem? What's interesting to me, though, is we're really kind of getting into this era, and I'm curious if more will spin from this, of these SNL-based movies. Yeah, we have Jason Reitman's SNL movie coming out about the first thing. Now we're getting this thing about Chris Farley, which I think SNL will be very heavily involved in it because, you know, Chris Farley shined bright, but he shined quickly.
Yeah.
Or burned quickly, is that the expression?
I think so.
You know, and he was pretty much all SNL that entire time.
Yeah. And it also piques my curiosity of, like, who's going to play Adam Sandler and David Spade and Chris Rock, like, you know, the people who are around him. You know, that's going to be an interesting thing to see as well.
Exactly.
And I'm going to be very curious by their response to the film, news and, like, once it's out and stuff. So, yeah, I just thought that was an interesting one. What do you guys think about the Chris Farley biopic in the works being directed by Josh Gad? Let us know in the comments as we move on to the box office.
The box office.
Do you have our predictions from last week?
Oh boy, do I. All right, let's see. I had Godzilla Kong coming in at number one, followed by Civil War, Monkey Man, The First Omen, and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
Okay.
Over on your side, Dalton, you had Civil War, Godzilla Kong, Monkey Man, First Omen, and Ghostbusters. So we really just flipped one and two there.
Right, right. We were both wrong.
Oh boy. What else is new?
But both of us being wrong, that's crazy. Never happens. Happens all the fucking time. Coming in first this week was Civil War. I believe it's A24's first domestic number one opening. Made $25 million. Good for them.
Good for them.
Coming in second was Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, making $15.4 million, only dropping 50% from week two to week three.
Nice.
Coming in third, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, making another $5.8 million, only dropping 36% from week three to week four. Coming in fourth, fucking Kung Fu Panda 4, making another $5.5 million, dropping 29% week five to six. Coming in fifth, staying in there, Dune Part 2, making another $4.3 million in its seventh week. Monkey Man came in sixth, just behind Dune Part 2 at 4.1, dropping 59% from week one to week two. The First Omen came in seventh, but only dropping 55% from week one to week two. It's just been a lot of movies out. Which is a great thing, but I'm going to dive into a few different numbers here. Civil War has only opened domestically, so that 25 total is all it's at right now, on a production budget of 50. So it's already halfway there, and that was A24's most expensive film. Let me see here. Godzilla Kong, The New Empire has now made $436 million worldwide on a budget of 135, 3.2. Got him. Profitability. We made it. We made it. Godzilla rules all.
Hell yeah.
Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire has now made $159 million worldwide on a budget of 100, so 1.6. It's probably going to be a money loser, but if it keeps staying in the top five like this, who knows? We could see it kind of squeak over that line. Kung Fu Panda 4 is just crushing it. $423 million worldwide on a budget of 85. It's made five times that budget back already. I mean, good for DreamWorks.
Oh, yeah.
Doom Part 2, again, still crushing it. It's at $683 million worldwide now on a budget of 190, 3.6, made its money and some more. It's already on to purchase digitally, which is stupid as hell. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
But regardless, that's where we're at. Monkey Man, his worldwide total is now at $22 million. So it's
good for Universal. Moving and grooving.
Yeah. And it was made for a budget of 10, but was bought for 9, I believe.
Well, bought for 21 and then sold for 9. Yeah, so yeah. Universal's making out like a bandit on this deal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Good for them. First Omen has made $35 million worldwide on a budget of, I believe, was around the same. So it has some work to do, but hopefully.
Can I watch that one without seeing the other one, The Omen?
Yeah, it's a prequel.
It's a prequel. Okay.
So, by the way, not just saying this, The Omen, the original, is fucking good.
I've heard very mixed things.
I've never seen any of the sequels.
Oh, maybe that's right.
And there was a remake in like 2005. That's not very good. The original is fucking good.
What year did the original come out?
It was in the 70s. And by the way, guess who directed it? This is interesting. You're going to love this.
And this is So that's the 70s, and this movie is a prequel to that movie?
Yes.
Okay.
It was made in 1976. Richard Donner.
Oh.
So, okay. In a span... By the way, I talk about Richard Donner and what an amazing director he was. He passed away recently. If you want to talk about range, 76, The Omen. Mm-hmm. 78, Superman.
Okay.
Then he does a couple movies. 85, The Goonies. Mm-hmm. 87, Lethal Weapon.
Hell yeah.
Like, my man was killing it. There's some projects there in between, but like, what a range this guy had. Mm-hmm. And The Omen is fucking good. It's a great horror movie.
I will be highly adding that to my list then.
Yes. Yes. It's a great date horror movie too. Mm-hmm. It's super scary, especially for like the 70s.
Oh yeah.
Very good. Out of context, this means nothing to you, but remember this when you watch the movie. It's all for you, Damien. That line in context is fucking horrific.
Oh God.
Just wait for it. But yeah. And there's so many behind the scenes stories on that movie. I'm going into The Omen now. And the last shot was the editor's idea. This is a famous Hollywood story. I don't know how true it is. But the last shot of the movie was the editor's idea because Richard Donner apparently didn't want it. And the editor was like, dude, you have to end on this shot. And then apparently they did.
I look up the shot, is it a spoiler?
Yes.
Okay, I won't look it up.
It's lovely. Well, it's kind of a spoiler.
Got it.
But I really want to see the first Omen. I might go see it today. I see Spider-Man tomorrow.
Oh, nice. All right, Dalton, what are your predictions for next week?
Fuck you. I don't want to go first.
I don't want to go first.
Fine. So we got Ministry of Gentlemanly Warfare and
that's
Abigail.
What's the title?
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
There you go. The Ministry of Gentlemanly Warfare is...
That's just West Side Story.
I was trying to think of... What's the movie with Gary Oldman?
Darkest Hour. I'm not wrong.
No.
As Gary Oldman.
Darkest... What's the fucking one where he plays Churchill?
Darkest Hour!
That's not Darkest Hour.
Yes, it is!
That's the one I was thinking of. I thought Darkest Hour was the ship one we talked about.
That's Dunkirk.
No, not Dunkirk. There's another ship. Finest Hour.
There you go.
That's what... Anywho. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
And Abigail.
Directed by Guy Ritchie. Yes. Not Abigail.
But those are coming out.
Yes.
Here's where I'm struggling. Horror does well. But man, Ungentlemanly Warfare has been advertised a lot. And Civil War could stay, and you know.
Yeah. My thing about Abigail is I feel like they have not been marketing it mm-hmm. as the next film from Ready or Not and Scream directors.
Yeah. Fuck it. Here's what I'm going to do.
All right.
Abigail number one. I'm going for it. Number two, Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Okay.
Number three, Civil War.
Okay.
Number four, Godzilla. Fuck it, number five, Ghostbusters.
Okay, I'm going to go Abigail. I'm going to go Civil War.
Ooh.
I'm gonna
okay.
go Ministry. I'm going to go Godzilla. And I'm going to go Kung Fu Panda.
Yeah, that's probably smart. God damn it.
I mean, it's not smart me putting Civil War above Ministry. Mm-hmm. Because, what, Civil War did 25, so 50% on a good day would be, what, 12? Mm-hmm. And I think Ministry will clear that. Abigail definitely will.
Yeah.
I could see Ministry getting to 15, but I'm going to stick with Civil War just in case.
Yeah, it's possible. It's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. By the way, all the numbers we gave today are the Sunday estimates. We'll have the final Monday numbers in the description below. Anything else to add, Nicholas?
No, I think that's all I've got.
All right.
Be on the lookout for reviews for yes. Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare and Abigail yes. later this week.
Both will be coming this week. And be on the lookout for, you know, other shit. Who knows? Maybe I get inspired. I won't. Thank you guys so much for watching, and we'll see you on the next one.